The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very glad you could join me today, March 8, 2014. I have another very special guest for you, someone who's been on the Heretics Hour in the past, but it's been a long time. I think the last time was 2011. My, how time flies. My sound level is not doing too well, although the music was way up there. So we were trying to adjust our sound, my guests and I, before it started. So I have to keep watching that to see if I need to increase my own sound level. Anyway, my guest is Eric Hunt, filmmaker, who has a brand new film out, which is a real attention getter, and with a bold name, The Jewish Gas Chamber Hoax. So I want to say hello and welcome, Eric.
Thanks. Nice to talk to you again.
All right. Well, I think the sound is good now. It looks pretty even. So I'm always talking about the sound at the beginning of my shows. People must be getting pretty tired of that because I never can, you know, I'm always a little bit worried about it. Here's something that I think I figured out. I think that low voices, low sounds don't need to be as loud. And when they're higher pitched, they go a lot louder, but they don't really sound any louder. You know what I mean?
So, that's
sorry,
true.
I'm starting out this way. I just figured this out because the music for this program is real, has these real high notes. And it was like going up to 10,000 and 9,000. I thought, wow, because I've never really looked at it while that music was playing, I guess. But now it's just fine. So. All right. Well, you know, I mentioned how time flies and how long it's been, Eric, since you've been on my program. And as I said, you were on the, you're on the Heretics Hour. I didn't have this Saturday afternoon program at the time. Have these last few years flown by for you too?
You could say so. Almost shocking. As you get older, it's just incredible how fast time flies. Yeah.
Well, right. See, you're already feeling it, and you're not very old. but yeah, wait till you get my age.
Exactly.
And they really go by, everything really goes by fast. But the more you do, the slower it goes because, you know, you've got so much going on. So that's something. And now you've really gotten busy again. I'm not going to ask you when you started unless you want to tell us when you started on this new film, but this film is getting a lot of attention, and I have watched it a couple of times. Well, I watched it again today to without any distractions or anything, and to be real fresh about it. And, of course, the first time I watched it, I liked it very much. Everybody has wonderful things to say about it, which is good.
Not everyone, of course. The opposition hates
well,
it.
Have you heard from them yet? I haven't heard anything from them yet.
Yeah, it's really pathetic, their rebuttals. So if the listeners want to watch the video, they can go to our website. It's gaschamberhoax.com and watch it for themselves.
Yes, I imagine most of them that are listening at this point already have watched it because they're probably people that are really interested in you and your work.
Well, it's only been released for a few days, so yeah.
Well, I must have. I guess I was told about it immediately as it was.
Yeah.
And I went there and I watched it a little. I think that evening. Well, there's a lot to say about it. I've got a lot to say about it, but I want to let you kind of start. You already gave us the website and how to get there. And you have some information written there that people should read. I think you've added some recently, mm-hmm. maybe. People should read all that. But what would you like to say about this film and just whatever you want to say about it?
Okay, yeah. So the movie, The Jewish Gas Chamber Hoax, the primary thing people will get out of it is there's a lot of new information, in particularly about Treblinka. We're told that Treblinka was a pure extermination camp where almost everyone was immediately sent to these gas chambers disguised as shower rooms. But using Steven Spielberg's own USC Survivors of the Shoah Visual History Foundation, this is a collection of over 50,000, quote, testimonies of, quote, Holocaust survivors. I was able to show that approximately 10,000 Jews were transited through this camp. Revisionists claim that Treblinka operated as a transit camp. It was not a pure extermination camp where these Jews were sent to gas chambers disguised as shower rooms, gassed with diesel exhaust, and then buried, then dug back up, cremated, and reburied. And apparently the traces of this 1 million are not to be found there today. The reason that there are no remains of over almost 1 million Jews there is because they were sent to other camps. So before this film was released, the Holocaust industry really able to get away with this lie that I have the senior historian of the United States Holocaust Museum offered. I specifically emailed him to get a quote for the film. He says that only 200 people,
Eric,
maybe.
You're breaking up
less
a little bit here
would.
And there. So I'll just have to, maybe it's going to come and go because of your location or something. So if you break up some when you're saying something that seems pretty important, I'll ask you to repeat.
All right, let me see if this is better.
Repeat what you were saying about the head of the U.S. Holocaust Museum.
Well, yes, I have him on record saying that less than 200 people were transferred total through these, quote, camps, Treblinka and Sobibor. And I'm able to prove in this video. That almost 10,000 were transferred through the camps.
Okay, and he said, yeah, and he's on record, and they're all on record as saying that every Jew that was sent to Treblinka was sent directly to the gas chamber, unless they were selected to be Sonderkommando or big slaves or something or else.
They say like a handful of strong, skilled men were sent for labor at the adjacent labor camp. But this video proves that women, children, absolutely unskilled, worthless for labor, prime candidates for the so-called gas chambers were simply sent to other camps, exactly as the Nazis, Germans claimed.
It agrees with some of the latest research by the revisionists who have done the most work in this area. Well, I know you know that the ones Carlo Mutonio and Jürgen Graf have done the most work on these three so-called extermination camps in eastern Poland. And then Thomas Kues had joined them after they had already published a few books between the two of them. And he's done some important work. And what he has in that in their latest book, in which they it did come out as a book, in which they did a rebuttal to what those five bloggers wrote about what they wrote. He was giving a lot of information about train schedules and trains that went, not just the schedules, but shown train records, that these trains that were going around in that area were doing strange things like bypassing Treblinka from another camp, like, I didn't look that up, but
Malkenia, maybe Malkenia.
Well, what different places where you would think mm-hmm. that if they went to Treblinka, if they were near Treblinka, they would mm-hmm. be going to Treblinka. But no, they were transporting Jews here, there, and sometimes they were right close to Treblinka, but they went right by it and went somewhere else. So obviously they were taking these laborers to different labor spots or labor camps and so on, rather than just taking them to be exterminated. And this was going on in 43 and 44.
I don't know about 44, yeah, but 42 and 43.
Yeah, right. Sorry about that. Yeah. You're right. 43 when this was all supposed to be going on. So,
their book.
The best that we've had has been this kind of. This has been about the best information, plus those newspaper articles about Stalin sending all these Jews in Russia up to Siberia, which we can talk about a little bit later. But now the work that you've done is something totally original and new that only you've been doing, because you've been researching into these Shoah Foundation testimonies and finding all kinds of stuff. And now you found this, and here we have these survivors themselves talking about how they were sent to Treblinka, and then they were there for maybe a few hours or a few days or a week, and then they were, and nothing, you know, nothing bad happened to them. They said they sat around, they were fed, they were, you know, they didn't do anything, and then they were transported somewhere else to a camp to work.
Yeah, it's, you know, Carlo Mattogno and Jürgen Graf's book is called Treblinka, Extermination Camp or Transit Camp. And this is just more evidence to help prove that Treblinka was indeed a transit camp. And I've accessed the Shoah Foundation before. Other people may have seen my last documentary called The Last Days of the Big Lie. This is something you actually had a big part in helping get accomplished and finance and help promote. So you definitely.
Well, thank you. That's nice of you to say that.
Well, it's true. We need this kind of help just because of the stigma, et cetera. We don't really. It's almost impossible for us to compete with these Hollywood cretins. So we're hoping to start basically a revisionist film studio. We're calling it 20th Century Hoax. It's a play on 20th Century Fox, as well as Butz's landmark book, The Hoax of the 20th Century.
That's another thing I wanted to mention, that I just love the beginning of this show and your trademark 20th Century Hoax. It looks so perfect, and it's such a good, whatever you call that, video art or something, computer art.
I didn't invent that. I've seen that. I've seen like a Photoshop of that before, but I wanted to have a real, actual 3D graphic, and I had that. I had that made, and I agree. It looks pretty fun and cool, and it sort of reminds people about the trickery. At first, you think it's the 20th Century Fox logo, but you know, like when you look at something closer, you see that it's actually not as it seems.
Right, right. I mean, it's just perfect in every way I can think of. It's so professional looking, and it does look like the real thing. So you think, okay, 20th Century Fox. You know, and then you look and you see it says hoax, and that just hits you so beautifully. You know, I mean, it's just a great. And along with that, Eric, is that what I love about what you do is that you use the word hoax, and right up in that 20th century thing, and other places too. But and you use the word Jewish in this title, and that's something that most people are still not ready to do. Most revisionists wouldn't want to do it. But you're calling it what are you calling it? The Jewish
gas chamber hoax. The Jewish gas chamber hoax. Yeah, I mean, I was having trouble titling this thing. I came up with almost 100 different titles, asking so many people about titles. Nothing really clicked. But then I realized none of the titles had this the word Jewish in it, because I also have been avoiding using this word. When you criticize Jews, and of course this is this goes beyond criticism, using the word Jewish or Jew is worse than the word nigger. So most people are totally afraid of using this word, but it just fits. It calls them out as being the prime people behind this. Of course, you know, the Americans, British, Soviets, even Polish underground, etc., played a part in the larger hoax. But especially today, the Jews are, as a community, using this, and they're pushing it and they're promoting it. They're directing the hoax, essentially. People like Spielberg are directing fiction.
I think if it wasn't for the Jews, if it was still just an allied thing, war thing, I think it would have started to die out like these things do, you know. But it hasn't, because it's so useful and valuable for the Jews. Not that it isn't valuable for the others, but they don't need it as much as the Jews do.
No, they have an entire country now for their, full of over 6 million Jews, and they use this as a as a offensive shield. And this Holocaust narrative, this false Holocaust narrative, negatively impacts almost everyone around the world, especially European Americans, of course, Palestinians, and countries in the Middle East, people all over the world.
And, you know, who are the people in the film? Are there any people that you feature in that film that aren't Jewish?
Trying to think of it. See? Well, just looking at the imagery right now, I have a picture of a man. He's connected to a gas chamber and sucking in diesel exhaust. This is another interesting segment of the film. There definitely are some non-Jews in there.
Most of them are not. Things.
Yeah, most of them are not used directly in connection to the quote Holocaust, though.
Right, and all those testimonies that are at the Shoah Foundation. What do they say they have? What is the number that they say they have?
Over 50,000.
Yeah, and they're pretty much all Jews.
It's almost all Jews. There's some, like, quote, liberators that are non-Jews. But it's almost all Jews. So that, and of course, that's only a percentage of the, quote, survivors that they were able to interview on film. So let's see. This is 50,000. It appears to be only mostly American Jews. And, of course, the number of, quote, survivors is multiple times that amount. So, you know, this calls into question, hey, why, if they, when were they eventually going to get around to gassing you, Irene Zisblatt? When were they going to get around to gassing you, Zelda Gordon, these bizarre people? They were fed, kept alive for years at a time. They never really tried to gas any of these, quote, survivors.
No, and so now, you know, I just forgot what I was going to say. Bad thing that happens to me. Right, so they're all saying that they were going to be gassed. And, well, another thing that I just might as well say right now is that they... You bring out so well that they say, no, they never saw any of this. They never even saw the gas chamber, except for those like Irene Zisblatt, who says she was in one, and some of them say they are in one. But they'll say, well, did you see it? Isn't it good that those questioners ask them? Because I guess they're told to get everything these people know. So they do some pretty good questioning. And then they say... No, I didn't see it. Another one said, I didn't see anything. Oh, you could never see anything. But I saw him leave, you know. I saw him walk into a room. I saw him walk away.
Yeah.
And then they really believe, I think a lot of them do really believe, some of them probably don't, that, that's what happened to him because that's what they're, what everybody says.
Well, a lot of them were duped both. They some of them heard the rumors during the war that they would go into these, quote, gas chambers. Some of them heard about it after the war. So if they're told by all his, quote, respectable historians and that what the people that they didn't see anymore were immediately gassed, that's what they're going to think. That's what they're going to tell you. But, yeah, some of the interviewers have follow-up questions. Oh, did you see them go into a gas chamber? No, I didn't see anything. Oh, then, of course, if they're on a witness stand, anything they say about gas chambers is just hearsay, not admissible in American court of law. Yeah, I point out that, put it this way, of course, there were real showers that were involved, not these showers disguised as gas chambers. Gas chambers disguised as shower rooms. There were real showers involved. So they see these people go to another building, and some of them actually do know were showers because they took the showers themselves. Some of them are genuinely shocked that water came down from these shower heads instead of gas.
Yeah, but don't you think some of those people, those three women you start out with, they are all three so unappealing, unattractive, unbelievable, uncredible. But that last one, the third one, to me, I've seen the first two before, but the last one I've never seen before. And it's like they try to make themselves as ugly as possible while they are. The first two were, I guess, in some ways you think they're trying to fix themselves up as nice as possible. But that third woman with that chin hanging down, like so gross. I mean, and you didn't pick her out because she looked so bad, but she was just having a good time telling about how the water. They went in and they don't tell. They thought they were going to be gassed. But that's a miracle! The water came out. Then she grinned and smirked, you know, like she was in on the joke. So she's probably heard that so many times that people saying, "Oh, we went into even in Schindler's List." I mean, they were afraid they were going into the gas chamber, but water came out. So she's just, you know, repeating all that. Not to say she wasn't. It didn't. Maybe she experienced it. But whether she did or didn't, she's heard other people say it.
Well, in some ways they've been tricked, but in some ways I think deep down I think they know they're deliberately exaggerating to promote Zionism. For instance, Zelda Gordon, the freakish woman with the beehive haircut and terrible makeup job. Some people say they can't even watch her. And she clearly describes in another quote testimony that she was in a shower room where people were getting undressed and taking showers. But, you know, in her show, foundation testimony, you've got to make it good. You got to make a good story. So she talks about being inside a quote gas chamber and being pulled out at the last minute. But it was a real shower, if anything.
Well, right. Now I just remember what I was going to say before that popped into my mind. And that was in the stories that these people are telling, it really comes through how well the Germans were treating them and how they were. Well, it might not be well in the sense that this is what you would like to have happen, you know, I mean, because you are being turned into a forced laborer. But they were taking care of their health. I mean, they were doing all this disinfection, which needed to be done. And then they would say, oh, they had us take off our clothes. But then they made us go and take a shower. And then they did this. And then we got new clothes. And and put those on. They were all clean, and you know, and then we were sent somewhere else. Well, you know, and it all makes sense. I mean, it's not mistreatment except for the idea that they were,
I mean, yeah, I mean, I just want the real story. Yeah, they were mistreated. Yeah, some of them were shot. Yeah, some of them were hit, abused, starved. It doesn't really matter when it comes to it. If we're talking about soap, lampshades, and gas chambers, it never happened. And I want to know the real story, not these phony fairy tales. So let me think. So we're talking about showers and also Zyklon B. So in both instances, we're told the opposite. We're told that the showers were used to kill people, and the Zyklon B was also used to kill people. Well, the showers were used to disinfest them, to protect, to wash away the deadly disease-carrying lice and fleas. Of course, typhus was just rampaging throughout the whole camp system. And, of course, the pesticide, Zyklon B, which the Americans use and still is used today all around the world. It's a cyanide pesticide. It's used to disinfect, delouse clothes. And the best example of this you can see is actually Kurt Vonnegut, German-American, brilliant writer, of course, in his book Slaughterhouse-Five. He was a POW. He was captured by the Germans. So he describes being sent to a shower while simultaneously his clothes were being gassed and millions of disease-carrying lice and fleas were being killed. So this is what happened. They took showers, and while their clothes, et cetera, were gassed, all to keep them alive. So we're being told the opposite. You know, we're told that the doctors were there to kill them, such as doctor. All these Nazi doctors were used to do Frankenstein experiments on them. When the doctors were there to keep them alive, most of them, we're told that the pesticide was used to kill them when it was used to keep them alive, and we're told the showers were used to kill them too. It's just nonsense and doesn't belong in the year 2014. Like I said, this hoax is not going to survive the information age. And if I can get a proper team together, the Treblinka's hoax won't even survive the end of the year. If we're going to keep coming up with 10,000 more of these proof of transported Jews through this place. So,
okay, there's a little bit more I want to say about these people, but let me take up what you just said just now, and that is that the testimonies, you have quite a lot of them, but you have been banned from the archives there at the USC.
Well, Stanford University banned me after I showed after my last video. I'm not sure if it was actually. Yeah, I think it was after the last video. Of course, it's really embarrassing for Spielberg for us to show the uncut video of Irene Zisplat in particular. This is someone they selected to star in their Oscar-winning documentary, The Last Days. And, you know, they cleaned up her stupid fairy tales. And I was able to share with the world the uncut testimony of this liar talking about being selected to become a lampshade. Of course, her calling card is repeatedly defecating diamonds for a year and a half while in Auschwitz and on death marches. She also claimed she was given a lethal injection. She also claimed she was inside a gas chamber and was pulled out and then thrown over the barbed wire fence onto a train. You know, her lies are just one ridiculous lie on top of the other. And when you see the uncut video, which they don't want you to see, it just becomes incredibly obviously clear. And that's prime reason they banned me.
Yeah. Well, does that mean that you can go to a different one and get these? My question was, oh, I see. Because my question was that you have a certain amount that you have already acquired, but to get more, you know, can you get more yourself, or you need somebody else to do that for you? But how many, you know, how much, I imagine, you know, really to really get everything that can be gotten from this source, it should all be looked at, and that's a huge job.
Well,
but it should all be looked at, and you never know what you're going to find. I've gone back and looked again at things when I thought I had enough, and found amazing things. I thought, gosh, I'm glad I came back here because, you know, there's you just never know.
Well, you know, they have their own YouTube site, and there's no reason they can't put all of their testimonies on a site such as YouTube if they really had nothing to hide. But what they do is they handpick the quote testimonies that fit their pure extermination stories, gas chamber lie, etc. And they don't really put a lot of these Jews who maybe their stories aren't interesting, but some of them tell the truth about things such as cultural activities inside the camps, and some of them don't exaggerate and paint a real picture about, you know, their actual suffering inside the camp, and rather than these fairy tale Hollywood Zisblatt Wieselian lies. And yeah, there's no reason they can't put all of their testimonies up. They started this quote so that future generations wouldn't be able to deny. But all you do when you it's a treasure trove for revisionists, and this is why they need to ban access to this archive. They ban access to almost all the important archives because they will prove things such as what I was able to accomplish, which is that tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands were transited through these, quote, pure extermination camps, and essentially the gas chambers, the homicidal gas chambers never existed.
Yeah, well, can it be exposed? You know, I mean, how do you expose, as you're doing it right now, but I mean, in a bigger way, that that they're selective. They talk about selection, you know, that in the camps,
yeah.
You know, they selected people for death and so on. Well, they're selecting what can be seen and what can't be seen. And yet maybe this has worked against them, you know, I imagine you've thought about
it. One way I'm able to do that is I'm able to show the people that they select themselves and expose them as total liars. So they really like to pick these super Zionist willing liars, willing actors, mm-hmm. and push them to the forefront. And I'm able to show that in my video.
Yeah, it shows it. So, but here's the thing, not to be, but just to say what they're going to, how they're going to counter this is that then they, or even people who don't want to believe it, you know, who want to keep believing in the atrocities and so on,
yeah.
They will say, well, this is a few people and he took part of what they said. And he didn't take all of what they said and there must be more to it. And, you know, they'll just get around it that way and ignore it, try to ignore it and not face reality there. So it seems to me that it will be necessary to put out more and more and more. I mean,
exactly, and that's what we're going to do. They're going to keep minimizing the immensity of this. You know, like I said, I have the senior historian of the United States Holocaust Museum saying only 200 were maybe transferred through Sobibor and Treblinka, and this is video proof of over 10,000. I mean, being transferred.
Where do you come up with the 10,000 number?
You can hear them for themselves talking about 100, 200, 300, 500, 356, and they're on different transports. Plus, there are about three Jews that I have that talk about entire trainloads full of men, women, and children. So trainloads are at least 1,000. Usually there are 2,000 to 3,000. So if you add up all the about 20 or so Jews, maybe more in my video, it comes to approximately a figure of about 10,000 transported through Treblinka. And, of course, there's more to be found. This is only one archive. Open access to other archives would totally demolish the story. And if I had access to any of it, of course, I can promise you that I'd be able to do just that.
When you were going through the testimonies of these individuals that you've used on this film, did you find more things, or is this about the extent of what they say that's useful? Or is there more things that you could find more if you went,
I don't know about the Shoal Foundation. One of the way I would have to, they catalog it pretty well. So, I don't know if there's necessarily any more, testimonies in that particular archive that would talk about this. There are some that I have.
Well, say,
that
so
are
they
not.
Have a cat. There's a they catalog it so that they say, well, these I mentioned Treblinka, something
well,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
So you got those.
I don't have all of them, but I do have the ones that specifically mentioned being transited from Treblinka within a period of a few short hours or days, which prime authorities on the Holocaust, such as the United States Holocaust Museum, say never ever happened.
Mm-hmm. And but they give you that much information as you're deciding which ones to access.
Well, the key word I searched for was transfer from Treblinka. And if you look up this, you can find, I think it's 20, 25. And then I would go through that, weed out some that were incorrectly labeled, and go from there. I think I also did go through all the Treblinka. They have brief keywords, so I sort of just glanced through them. I might go back through that just to double check, but it's mostly on to some other archives, I think.
You're really a good researcher, Eric.
Well, I think I'm good at finding information. I even considered being a librarian at one time just because I'm sort of interested in and very – I think I'm good at finding information that other people can't find. So, yeah, thanks.
Yeah, I think so too, because I've noticed it all the time I've known you that you're really good when you get going. And then you have good computer skills growing up with it and all of that. So it's a great combination. You are a real treasure for our side, and people need to, as you say, people need to put their money where their mouth is. So many people are praising, so lavish with their praise, and you think they must be donating. No, they're not,
Well, yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Yeah, I mean, some people are remarking how professional it is. In my opinion, it's really not professional yet, but I'm showing you it can be. If we have proper equipment, if we have proper funding, people, you look at the graphics such as at the beginning, the 20th century hoax, and I'm trying to show to people that we can create completely professional, high definition, just indistinguishable from an actual Hollywood documentary if we have the proper funding. So I'm hoping people will be able to donate for this cause. The website's gaschamberhoax.com, and we're trying to make a professional quality revisionist film studio. And, I've got two movies under my belt to show you what I'm capable of. And I think I'm constantly trying to improve and try to make it more and more professional, try to improve our production values, try to reach more people. My last movie, The Last Days of the Big Lie, has well over 500,000 views on YouTube and other sites, and this one should go well over that. And if any of the viewers would just donate something, anything, we could really start making more great materials. And we want to end this sick, sick libel against the German people, and like I said, it not only affects German people. As Americans, we've only heard this in our whole lives, and somehow the European people in America have felt guilt over this, that we had nothing to do with. In fact, we tried to we were the ones who liberated these people, but it's all we hear about as Americans. as if we're to blame. And it's about something that actually never happened. This gas chamber story never happened.
Well, a lot of things never happened that they talk about. But that's the big one, and that's where everybody's in agreement on that, everybody in the revisionist movement. So that's the place to and it's amazing that it lasts still. It's really amazing that it continues to stand and people still believe in it. They just like it. It's like a horror movie.
Yeah. It's like religion. It's like religion. It's a or any other delusional belief. They do like it. It does make them feel better. It justifies their wars. It's a lie that justifies preemptive wars. Of course, we've also heard how Saddam Hussein had gas chambers. It justifies almost every modern belief that the West is essentially committing suicide by worshiping this hoax. So there's a lot of reasons that it still stands.
Yeah, that's where the white politicians come in, and governments and so on, not just the Jewish community. It's that's where they come in, because they use it to justify everything that they've done and are doing since World War II, and their own attacks on other nations is growing, keeps growing larger and larger, and they still bring up the Holocaust to say, oh well, we have to prevent this and that, and the Jews are involved in so much of it, and they say, well, you can't say, you know, you can't accuse the Jews of any of this because that's so anti-Semitic, and then that brings up the Holocaust, and the whole thing is like you, as you say, and I know how strongly you feel it. It's just so sick. It's so sick. And so many of us are just have had it with this sickness, and we'll do a lot to overcome it. And I think what you're getting across to people is that you believe it can be done. You are willing to work hard to do it. And you have done all this work with nothing, basically, you know, just the help some help from me in getting the material from the archives and maybe from some other people, but basically, you know, you're able to do all this with very little. But people shouldn't expect that you can keep doing that all your life, you know.
The reason I wasn't able to make a film since The Last Days of the Big Lie is just funding. After the last movie, you know, some people helped. You're one of them. Since then, I just don't have the ability to fund the research, production, travel expenses, etc., on my own. But Friedrich Paul Berg, the revisionist engineer, was able to get a little bit of funding for this, and that's how we were able to produce this. So if you want to see more projects, if you want the end of this sick gas chamber guilt trip, here's an option for you. We've got the people in this cause. I want to build a team. I want to buy a camera. We're making documentaries without cameras now and the proper sound equipment especially. And I'm trying to show you that we have the willingness to do it, and we just need your help. We just need listeners, viewers' help. Not everyone can be out front with their name. A lot of people have to be anonymous, but there's something that people that are anonymous can really help us to do, and they could be heroes by just helping out this projects like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think so too. I think it's very heroic, and there's, I can't think of anything more worthwhile. Okay, let's go back we've got 15 minutes in this first hour, and then, ladies and gentlemen, in the second hour, I'm going to take calls. So, Eric would actually like to get some calls and hear people and answer some questions if you have any questions, or, you know, want to discuss anything. So the number will be, but not don't call until after the in the second hour, till after the break. 1-830-443-4911. I'll repeat it then. But let's go back for a little bit to these people in the film. And you know what strikes me is that as I was saying, that those first three that you start out with, those three women, and then all of them follow along. They're these they're Jews with the same accent. They all sound to me, of course I don't have a ear for all the nuances, but they all sound to me like they have basically the same kind of accent. Mm-hmm. Probably from Yiddish or something. But they there they were, safely put away in their ghettos in Eastern Europe, you know, and not bothering anybody that I knew of. And then this thing actually liberated them, and they've moved all over the world, but particularly to United States and also Europe, though, and, of course, to Israel, which is okay if they're in Israel. But and they now have all kinds of opportunities, and there they are, but they still have this old ghetto-ish mentality and this kind of lack of education or lack of awareness, lack of sophistication in what that people wouldn't believe this stuff they're saying, or that, you know, that they're living in some kind of a crazy way of thinking, which they were known to have been in, you know, in their ghetto life, you know, that they, mm-hmm. they were certain kind of people, and they're big storytellers and they believe stories, or they don't, it's there again, it's like what you were saying. Do they believe it, or do they just enjoy acting like they believe it and talking to each other like they believe it and so on? So they're very distinct people, and they've come into a more modern Western world, and people just had all this sympathy for them and just, you know, allowed them to do and say and be anything they wanted, and they've gotten, they get money. You could say, well, they've gotten jobs and, you know, they're better off now. But also they all get money. It's just not enough, I guess, for them to live in the way that they're accustomed to, that they seem to be able to live. But it's enough to help them out quite a bit over the rest of us. So there they are. We're now infiltrated with all of these weird thinking people and weird looking, too, if you ask me. It's kind of too bad. I wish they were still back where they were then, and this hadn't happened.
They know they have the upper hand. They know they have control. They know that the goyim are gullible, and that we have to accept this lie, or they're going to ruin your reputation. They're going to bankrupt you financially, maybe even throw you in jail if you're in certain countries where this is illegal to talk about. So they feel free. Irene Zisplat feels totally free to, and also Elie Wiesel, of course, they feel totally free to just make up stories about, for instance, Wiesel walking directly towards a flaming pit of fire where babies were dumped into with a dump truck. But what the revisionists say is, okay, can you point out on a map or on the Auschwitz ground where you saw this mass grave where you just happened to walk by and saw these flaming pits of fire where the babies were dumped into? But he can't do it. They can't do it. Their atrocity lies, and no journalist, mainstream journalist, has the balls, really, to expose any of these. My film, The Last Days of the Big Lie, has been out for, 3 years now? It's so obvious what a horrific, scatological liar Irene Zisplat is, yet no mainstream journalist wants to go near this story, which is a huge story, that this Oscar-winning documentary is a complete fraud, and it's an offensive fraud. They're really confident.
Well, you know, a journalist would lose his job immediately.
Exactly. So
immediately. And I don't care on any paper if it wasn't Jew-owned or whatever, and if it was a more not so extremely politically correct paper. No, nobody is allowed to do that. And you just have to ask yourself that's you have to make a comparison to that with times in the past and other places that we think were so terrible, and yet that's going on in our world. But people think that what is said is true. I don't know how they can think that. They just overlook it. Another thing I was going to say that about lies, you know, people, even our people, most people lie a little bit, you know, or have lied or something, and they excuse. People are not, don't seem to get upset about lies. And I, of course, found that out a lot with this Elie Wiesel website. But there is, there's many other ways, you know, in this, in that you can see that people will write and they'll say, well, so he lied. Well, so maybe this person lied a little bit. Look, they still suffered, you know, and, so you should be sensitive to that. And on they go. That's how easy, and yet lies, I like also, Eric, the way you feel it so strongly, you understand it and you mention it and point it out. That lies are horrible, and these big lies are just, they're murderous, and they kill people, and they destroy people. They're very bad. There's not something you can overlook.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, Arthur Butz, who wrote The Hoax of the 20th Century, if you look at the actual, quote, big lie quote from Hitler, you know, we're always told that this big lie technique was something Hitler used to trick the masses of Germany into supporting him. But if you actually read the quote, he says that this big lie technique is a technique used by the Jews to trick the Goyim, essentially, because we can't even imagine that they would lie this big. We can't even wrap our brains around that. For instance, that there are Jews who claim that they personally removed gassed women and children from gas chambers and threw them into ovens for. We can't imagine that they would lie about that, and that's why they get away with it, is because it's a big lie and it's their technique that they use to destroy.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, they do. They destroy things. They destroy people. They destroy whole nations and countries. They destroy perfectly good ideas.
Exactly.
And place bad ones. So, but you know, it's not just the big lie. Even that people are do not want to hold people all that accountable for lying. And I think that's a big mistake.
Well, it's not only that. It's myth. People like myth. And of course, what's a bigger myth makers than Hollywood and of course, in my opinion, religion, which also comes from the Jewish storytelling tradition. You know, what's the big movie now in the box office? It's Russell Crowe in Noah. But you know, just like the Exodus story about Moses parting the Red Sea, it's absolute Jewish supremacist fairy tales, and so are the gas chambers, so are the soap stories, so are lampshades. But okay. People like it. They like these myths. It makes them feel better, and especially for Americans, it makes them justify the firebombing that Americans and British were involved in, just destroying cities such as Dresden, and of course after that, nuclear bombs. You never hear about an American war criminal or a British war crimes. No, but the victors write the history. So,
yeah, you know, I wonder if this idea of how people like myth and people also like exaggerated stories wherein there's the good guy and the bad guy, you know, and so atrocity propaganda always goes over big. I wonder if there could be a film made around that theme. I don't know how you'd do it. That would really be convincing in people's eyes, because that's another part of it. Is why do people keep wanting to believe this stuff?
Well, it's a lot of it's goes back to religion, and this is demonization at its most obvious. Hitler in particular is portrayed as Satan incarnate, and the Germans Nazis are his little demons. But when you look at it, especially the people that were on trial and some of these innocent women, also that were put on trial. I was just reading about Irma Grease, who, you know, she's writing letters to her family while in prison. She's horrified. She doesn't want to be hung like a witch because, of course, that was a witch trial. They were real people, and they deserve a defense, and they don't need to be liable by this hearsay, which I prove in my film, about gas chambers. So there is no physical evidence there that proves that 1 million Jews were at Treblinka. There are no 1 million remains of these, quote, gas Jews under the ground at Treblinka. While I show, and others have shown, of course, such as Jürgen Graf, such as Germar Rudolph, that these Jews were transited to other camps. That's why, you know, currently there's an archaeological team, quote, playing around Treblinka with ground-penetrating radar. But they're not going to be able to find these 1 million remains because, of course, 1 million were not gassed and buried there.
Well, that's right. There's no way they're ever going to find them. We know. I mean, it's just amazing when you have to watch this show go on. When you know what the truth is, and anybody who wants to really think about it knows, but they just show just keeps going on. Well, we got to dig some more. We'll find these bodies.
She's going to have a new documentary come out actually later this month on the BBC, but I think this documentary is one of the things that really help debunk her little farce that she's called. Her name is Coles, British archaeologist at Treblinka.
That's right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to the break, and Eric, hold on, stay on the line until we come back. We'll be back in 5 minutes, and we have... we have the early American music.
Down in the valley so low, hang your head over, hear the wind blow, hear the wind blow, dear, hear the wind blow. Don't love me, love whom you please. Throw your arms round me, give my heart ease.
Give my heart ease, dear, give my heart ease. Throw your arms round me. Give my heart ease.
Roses love sunshine, violets love dew. Angels in heaven know I love you. Know I love you, dear. Know this valley, they say you are leaving. We will miss your bright eyes and sweet smile. For they say you are taking the sunshine that has brightened our pathway wild. Come and sit by my side if you love me. Do not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember the Red River Valley and the one who has left. sweet words you never would say. Now at last all my fond hopes have vanished for the sake that you're going away. How about a mandolin solo? This is the verse that that makes me think I kind of know why the guy's going away. Because she is whining. Do you think of the valley you're leaving? Oh, how lonely, how drear it will be. Do you think of the kind heart you're breaking? And the pain that you're causing to me. Come and sit by my side if you love me. Do not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember the Red River Valley and the one who has loved you so true.
Take it, friend.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry at the last minute there. I was trying to find that artist who did the second song there. I think it's someone like Judy Boguff. I went to the White Network Saturday afternoon page, and I saw there I hadn't changed it yet from Woody Guthrie. Oh, boy. I thought I had, but I have to make that change, and I'll let you know next week who that singer is. But we had to get rid of Woody Guthrie because he was much too much of a communist. So my guest today on March 8th, 2014 is Eric Hunt. And are you back, Eric?
Yes.
Okay, good. And so this is the call-in hour, and I invite people to call in at 430-443-4911. And there was something I wanted to bring up, and that was about talking about the myth. You know, it comes to mind the phrase, the power of myth. And there's no way to get rid of myth, and we wouldn't really want to, because all cultures and united peoples and so on depend on certain myths, or they naturally have certain myths, and that unite them and hold them together. And I do believe that it comes down to politics as what we're always dealing with, because if what I thought was true and what I thought the way things should be were put in force, and I would be happy with it, and there would be certain myths that would be seemed pleasing to me and to those who think like me. Well, there's always going to be those who don't like it. They're not going to like it, and they're going to be opposed to it. So, and this comes down to then political thinking and which politics you want to have things based on. So I think that in order to really change all of this, it might be necessary to have different political regimes in power than the ones we have. Because these regimes are keeping this in, these, you know, the truth only goes so far in how much people care about it. Go ahead.
Well, a lot of the justification for flooding European countries with millions of non-Europeans is because of the Holocaust, and the reasons they can't deport them is because of the Holocaust. So, a lot of their regimes and their political views are totally supported by the Holocaust. Any country, even those not involved at all with the Holocaust, really pay a price. It doesn't matter if they fought against the Nazis, so.
Well, so that's why there's so much resistance. You'd think, more people would be listening to it, but they're always, people would listen to the kind of thing that you're doing if there wasn't so much propaganda put out, or what you call information, media information put out, opposite to what you're saying and what we're saying. So, this is, it's pretty hard to counteract that, but you're saying we need to get bigger, and if we get big enough, we could do a better job of it.
I think if we can just get professional enough, and the Jewish interest groups cut off our funding for a reason. This is how they can really affect us. So that's why we get banned from PayPal, etc. We have the truth on our side. So all we really need is somewhat of some financing to get the truth out. And of course, there's other persecution tactics, and of course, stigma, and just the general belief that they try to instill that anyone who denies this is pure evil. To dare question a historical event, or it's, and as a Westerner, especially looking at examples such as Galileo, I'm horrified. I don't agree with this. Your last show was called The Heretics Hour, so I don't think modern heresy has any place in a Western society.
Well, heresy is simply going against the grain, but to persecute heretics is what you're saying, right? That you don't think that has any place in a modern society.
Well, the concept of heretics shouldn't exist. It's basically people that don't believe the prevailing belief system, I guess. So I think even the concept of heretics, if Holocaust denial is really so unfounded, so untrue, why not just laugh at it? Why not just destroy us through debates? No, they have to imprison people such as Germar Rudolph and other peaceful scientists, engineers, etc., authors such as David Irving. This is a horrible period in Western history, but there are parallels to it, like I said, with Galileo and other periods of heresy. But you would think in 2014 we'd be beyond that, but no, not at all.
Well, that's why it comes down to political power, and people will do anything to retain political power. Not everybody would do anything, but a lot of people do. So
I think the best quote is what Orwell said: "He who controls the past,
controls the future."
Let me think of it. Yeah. He who controls the present controls the past. He controls the past controls the future. And that's exactly what they're doing.
Well, that's right. I don't know if it's possible to have a totally free society where everyone thinks what they want, and nobody's punished for it, and says what they want, and so on, and how would that society work?
Well, in my opinion, seeing this new dark ages, apparently European people are entering. Overall, I do believe there should be free speech, but if you're going to be pushing for genocide or against your own people, suicide of your own people and culture, I think perhaps something like that should be illegal. I think these traitors who are destroying all of these European countries by agreeing to be blended out of existence. Maybe things like that should be illegal, but overall, almost everything should be free for discussion.
Well, yeah, I think things should be free for discussion. I do. However,
this is an outside group forcing their hate beliefs on the host countries to basically make us commit somewhat of a suicide, make us easier to control. But as far as amongst European people, we should be almost totally open for open discussion. That's part of what Western civilization is about, you would think. We've all been told this, but I don't know.
Yeah, well, no, I agree with exactly what you're saying there, but it's like what they want is to control the narrative, and they're forcing through this thing about Holocaust, they're forcing every government to not allow anyone to say things that go against their narrative.
It's just a huge nightmare. They don't have the evidence. They could easily shut all of we quote Holocaust deniers up. We're just really people who look at the evidence, it's absurd. We're told that the Nazis essentially made the remains of 6 million Jews disappear.
Like Zelda said in one of her little parts there in your film, she says, "Well, we watched and I didn't hear a thing. It was so silent. And then it took just seconds for these hundreds of people to disappear."
Well, yeah, and she also describes a chimney. But we know that at Treblinka, there were no crematory ovens at Treblinka. They did have bakery ovens. So she talks about people going up chimneys after being burned, but even the Orthodox version is that there were no crematory ovens at Treblinka. They claim they had huge open pits, but of course they can't show us the remains in these huge open pits because they don't exist. The million Jews' remains would be so easy to show and would shut. Hell, I'd volunteer to work for Jewish organizations, whatever. If they could actually prove their claims, I would feel like I've made a horrible mistake. But they can't show it. And I think movies like mine, which you can watch at gaschamberhoax.com, prove that they don't have the evidence. And most of it just relies on hearsay as well as a lot of manufactured evidence that the Allies created after the war, such as the fake gas chamber of Dachau and the one they showed at tourists in Auschwitz.
You know, speaking of those bread factories, that's really interesting because for a while there was somebody on Kodo Forum trying to push this idea and he had a lot of interesting diagrams and stuff about these, even what is called the gas chamber, the crematoriums, as actually being bread factories with bread ovens in them. I think that was going too far. But they did have buildings called bakeries, yeah. And they had big ovens. And I think that's another thing that probably did get confused in there with the story about the big ovens in these camps and so on. Because these bread ovens were bigger than the crematory ovens.
I don't necessarily know that got confused, but certainly if like I said, the people are saying they saw smoke coming out of chimneys at Treblinka, well, that's not from a crematorium. That's right. We know that for 100%. Even the other side says that. But yeah, they did have ovens at that camp, but it was to make bread to keep these people alive. But as far as the Auschwitz, I don't believe that guy's theories.
Well, you know, if there were bakeries at at Treblinka. That would destroy the whole story if they have.
Well, it's not if. We know that there is a bakery at Treblinka. There are pictures of the building both during the war and actually after Soviet liberation. You can see a partially existent bakery there. And we're told that the Germans dismantled the entire camp, destroyed all traces. But you can see in the photograph that the Soviets took that the walls of this bakery still exist. So they demolished this. They hid the evidence of this bakery after they liberated the camps. So if tourists actually saw the remains of these walls of this actual bakery, maybe they'd have second questions about this. But why did the Soviets destroy the evidence at Treblinka? That's a good question. And some people say that the Soviets may have had the outbound train records that are seemingly missing from Treblinka, and either may have destroyed it or still have it somewhere in Russian archives. But we don't know that. But one thing we are trying to do because these outbound train records are absent, and you know we're supposed to assume that this means that all the Jews sent there were guests, we're trying to create these outbound train records ourselves from the Jews' own testimony of them talking about being transited through Treblinka.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yes, I heard you mention that before. That's very good. That's a lot of fine work to be done, a lot of time-consuming, tedious work. But that's how it's done. You know, you can't do it any other way. It doesn't come as some great big discovery. Oh, here it is, and this is the smoking gun, and now everything it blows the Holocaust out of the water. A lot of people like to talk like that, but it never happens that way. You know, and there isn't going to be anything like that, do you think?
Well, yeah. If we can continue to find tens of thousands of more of these Jewish transports, proof of these, that is the smoking gun. The reason that, and it corresponds to what we say about the mass graves. The reason they can't find these mass graves is simply because they were transited through. So, if we find the evidence of tens of thousands, you know, the Holocaust industry say this was a pure extermination camp. The senior historian of the U.S. Holocaust Museum says less than 200 were sent through. But if we're going to find tens of thousands, who knows, maybe even hundreds of thousands, proof of these people transited through these camps, some people say we already have it. That is the smoking gun, and they will not be able to continue to call this a pure extermination camp. And they will have to reclassify it as a transit camp, just as they changed the Auschwitz death figures and as well as the Majdanek death figures. The death toll of Majdanek was drastically reduced down to less than 80,000, I believe, right now. It was multiple millions, the Soviets claim. Now, it's almost certain that there were no gas chambers. Even the Orthodox side don't. Many of them don't claim gas chambers at Majdanek, and that's our goal about Treblinka and the other camps, that one day we're going to have so much undeniable evidence that they're going to have to both deny that gas chambers existed at Treblinka and that it operated as a transit camp, and that's one of the ways we can destroy the entire hoax. And
yeah, well, that's what I mean, though, that this has been a long process, and even what you're doing with Treblinka is a process of going through all these testimonies and then trying to figure out train schedules and so on, all that. It's not like you go and you discover something and that blows the whole thing wide open and it's all over with. I mean, what you're talking about is pretty much the weight of the evidence. Keeps growing.
Yeah,
it's not easy. So unwilling to accept, what revisionists come up with, you have to just keep piling it on.
Well, I guess it's like a court case. We're just going to have to come up with, you know, the general public is almost like the jury on this issue. So, unfortunately, really, the burden of proof should be on them. They're the ones claiming extraordinary, impossible things, such as diesel gassings, and that the remains of 1 million are under the ground at Treblinka. But you know, we're just going to have to keep coming up with more and more evidence and compile them, such as, you know, we've been doing in our various books and films, and just making just a rock-solid case that this is a really just a massive hoax. And there are a lot of parallels throughout history. Wartime propaganda is, and atrocity propaganda is nothing new. And, you know, we are going to win. I think things like this are going to show people it is possible to find this information. We thought it wasn't out there. It's out there. And especially because of the internet, the information age, we want to get as many people on our side looking into this as well and helping us for sure.
You know, I've answered this call. There's a call here. I've answered it three times. Finally got it. I wasn't even on the Skype page when I saw it. I said, oh, I start typing in the numbers. I wasn't even typing anything in at all. Okay, hello, caller. Would you give us your name and your where you're from?
My name is Gamaruda. You should know me.
Oh, hi, Gamar. Hey, it's great for you to call. Just great. Yeah.
Indeed, indeed.
What do you have to say?
Well, I have a question. First of all, the first question I have is, I don't know how old he actually is. I would like to know, just a brief question, how old are you, Eric?
We're having a little trouble with Eric again. Eric, you're breaking up again, but it should pass, I would think.
I'll be 30 in 3 months.
I think he's 30.
First of all, it's an honor to talk to Gamar. He's one of the real heroes of our indigenous movement.
Eric, we're not hearing you at all, just gurgling.
Turned into an alien.
Yeah. Well, you keep talking, Gamar. Maybe
okay.
I don't see anything on my end if he knows if he's having some Skype connection.
Better now?
You may?
Just for a second, it was there.
All right, well, I mean, Gamar Rudolph is one of the huge heroes of all revisionists. He's endured horrific persecution and jail time. He's one of every revisionist heroes. He's a great man. It's an honor to speak with you.
Yeah, well, thank you. I would like to give some of the praise back, because I think with the movie you've just produced, you put yourself into the role of heroes yourself. Because I think it's such a great, wonderful job. It's not perfect, nothing's perfect, as you've said before. Maybe we can sit down at some point and talk things over. But revisionists have been struggling for decades, ever since actually revisionism started after the war, I would say, to answer the central question, but if they're not dead, where did they go? If they couldn't have disappeared into thin air. And you've got a track there. Have you mentioned Thomas Kuhs has over the last several years tried to find documentary evidence of what has happened to the Jews that went through Treblinka and other camps, and he has made some inroads, but not really found any conclusive, absolutely convincing evidence, and you've now unearthed another source, another way of attacking the question from a different angle, and it's so wonderful to see that this work is being done. Another question that I have, what do you do for a living if you are able to answer that at all in public?
I'm an English teacher right now. That's what I do. I work as an English teacher. But what I wanted to say was that, that was one of my questions myself, and I've always had doubts. You know, why can't the revisionists try to prove where, you know, we're told 1 million went through? So, yeah, I wanted to answer some of my doubts as well and try to trace. It should be easy to find these tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and I think I've shown that it is possible, and we will continue to find much, much more.
Yeah. Now, the question about the profession had a reason, because if we really want to go, you're not talking about yourself, you're talking in plural, so I figure that you have several people around you to help you, support you.
I'm sorry, can I interrupt you? My background is I have a major in digital media. I and I have a bachelor's degree in digital media and an associate's degree in new media, multimedia. So I am somewhat filmmaking, you could say, is somewhat my background. I am able to do it, make websites, Photoshop, etc. I could do almost anything as far as digital media wise, but I've been handicapped mostly by the financial aspect. So,
because doing real good documentary can be a full-time job, and then you would need a full-time support for that, of course. How that would be possible when at the same time you have a full-time position, that's something you would have to answer. But I think, actually, whoever is out there listening now, listening in the future when they later on chime into that program or download it, they should really, as you've said, put the money where their mouth is or where their thoughts, where their hearts are. And you guys need to set up something, and everybody in the revisionist movement should chip in, because this is such an important approach to the whole issue, to getting the message out, to addressing others than the choir. All the books that have been published, some of them with my help over the past two decades, they have the disadvantage that they're hardly being read by anyone, and movies is actually what gets the message out, what reaches the masses, what can reach a plethora of new people of all walks of life, and that's the road to go. And I appreciate it, and I admire you for having been able to do that, and I'm looking forward to more.
Well, you know, Garamar, he's I'll just speak for a second for Eric, in that he would be happy to give up whatever part-time job work he does to make something of a living and to be a full-time filmmaker. And that's the idea. And I'm glad that you are saying that about we need to get out beyond the choir. And that the film is the way to do it. So he really, this is where promotion should come, I think. And he shows what he can do. And it's great that you say you'll talk to him about what you think about it. And, you know, everybody should put their two cents in if they have a good, you know, if they're qualified to do so. But this kind of working together is what's required. That's what we've always been lacking, would you say, to some extent?
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, we had the major fallout in the 93 when the revisionist movement in U.S. in the United States started a big infight, and ever since we've been struggling getting things together, back together.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. That was all I wanted to say, so thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you very much.
Clear the line again for others. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Garamar. What a nice surprise.
Yeah,
nice that you called in. Well, there we go. We had Garamar Rudolph as a call. There, he's gone. Can't do much better than that. And so someone else can call if you have any questions of Eric. So what do you say about that? Anything?
I was always hoping to talk to Garamar Rudolph. Yeah, so that's.
Oh, that's
really
the first time you've talked to him?
I'm not sure exactly, but I've had some email correspondence, but I will be speaking with him privately soon. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I just sort of got back into this quote.
Yeah, I thought maybe he had helped. I thought that maybe you had been in contact with him.
I think in the past he was facing a lot of legal issues. Of course, he's been in prison for I think almost 2 years.
He has his own need to keep a low profile.
Yeah, so he had to distance himself from people like me.
Like you. Oh, you know, well, they're watching all this. The one thing they don't want is for this revisionist movement, excuse me, to get a lot of cooperation.
To get moving. We've got to move forward.
Yeah. So there's going to be, you know, you have to be very careful. There's going to be stuff put in your way. For sure. All of a sudden, I've got the hiccups. Okay, well, but there are people out there who, like him, you know, big people who are really aware of everything that's going on, and he keeps his eye on everything and are willing to support it. And there's also got to be people. I mean, it's one thing to ask everybody to donate, and you can come up with quite a lot of money that way, and people don't have to give so much if you have enough people doing it. But also, it's going to require a few major donors, I would think. Yeah. Most things do, you know. Yeah. So, and but they're out there too. You just have to get to where you can, you know, and the more that you get ready, you know, the more that you're ready to go, the more of a plan you have, and you know, the more of a schedule and a program and everything, you know, you can present, the better, the easier it is to get money. So,
you and other people have talked about putting together a budget, but I'm just so used to operating on such a low budget. It's almost nonsensical to create a wish list or anything. I don't have any cameras right now.
Well, just start with that. You know, you need a camera. Yeah. I don't know how expensive this camera is.
I want a high quality camera. And it's not about me. It's about this film studio project we're trying to do. It's up to the viewers. You know, I'm trying to show I am capable, but like I said, we're a bit handicapped by just the lack of funding.
Yeah. You need a camera, and what else you need is just to start off.
We need the funding for cameras. You know, of course, audio is important, especially because I'm recording narrations. You know, there's no limit to
You need a few thousand dollars.
Yes.
Not so much. You know, of course, that's only to start, but you need a few thousand dollars. It shouldn't be such a problem in getting that, to me.
I've proven I can do things with very little budgets, but I think people would be shocked if we actually had some real budgets, what we'd be able to do, and how great, how clear, how incredible projects we can do. There are a lot of talented people in this movement. I'm not very good at motion graphics, some of the titling things you see in a lot of the professional movies, but you can see other short revisionist movies that look great. They look like professional documentaries. Some of them have a lot of animation. So we need more than one person working on these films. I'm almost doing everything myself. So if we want to win, we're going to have to actually do things like the project I'm proposing, the 20th Century Hoax little film studio, which requires, you know, funding to cover other people's expenses working along with me, and for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and you don't have any kind of legal problems hanging over your head. There's another call I'm going to answer. Answer that while I'm doing this. Do you? I mean, you're no more than anybody else, no more than me, say, or something.
No, I don't have any legal problems. No.
Just your name recognition.
Yeah.
Yeah. After.
Yeah. Yeah. Is
hey,
this Carolyn?
Hi, caller. Yeah. Please turn off your sound there. Your radio.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. We're hearing the.
Hold on a sec.
Audio.
Background.
It's important, especially because I'm recording narration.
It's Charlie Kraft.
Well, Charlie, another great caller. Welcome.
Boy.
Hey.
Yeah.
Am I on the air now?
Great
speaking. Yes, you are. Yes, you are.
Oh, okay. Well, congratulations on the production, Eric. Looks really good. I've watched it a couple of times.
Thanks. And you were helpful in telling me, trying to pick up the pace on it a little bit. I mean, it's not necessarily all entertainment. Like I said, I sort of have to present some of the information, or people are just going to think I'm selectively editing and things. So you were very instrumental in how I asked your opinions throughout the whole project. So thank you, too, for helping.
Well, you're welcome. And I thought, yeah, the pace is great. I was just concerned in the beginning that the stories were a little bit too long for the average person to be able to get the meat out of the nut, which was about their being transited on, you know, from Treblinka onto Majdanek and wherever.
Yeah, so, we're in a sort of new period here. I think in the future, revisionists are not going to necessarily present their findings in the form of lengthy books because, you know, even Steve Jobs says people don't read nowadays. So if a picture is worth 1,000 words, you know, what is video worth? So I think, like I said, it's not necessarily solely meant to be an entertaining documentary or anything. But it's sort of just presenting our findings, our information, and that's all I wanted to say. Sorry, continue.
Well, it proves that Itzhak Arad is a prevaricator because at the beginning of the movie you have him telling you that nobody left that place alive. And there you have the witnesses saying that they left alive.
Well, yeah, he sort of did something pretty stupid. He said an absolute... like that they went directly to the gas chambers, but even he or other people would say that some, quote, strong, skilled men were sent to the labor camp and maybe were transited later on to other camps. But, you know, Dr. Peter Black of the United States Holocaust Museum has more the quote, his email is more important because he doesn't use these silly religious absolutes that Arad says. He claims that I wanted a direct figure of the amount they claim were transited. So Arad doesn't give me this figure. He just tells me they went directly to the gas chambers, which is absurd. And Peter Black wrote that less than 200 were transited through Treblinka and Sobibor. And, yeah, they both shoot themselves in the foot and make total asses of themselves.
Right.
Well, tell them. Don't clue them in. Go ahead, Charlie.
Well, one of the things that I'd like to bring up, and aside from congratulating Eric on getting this thing done and doing such a splendid job with it, is in all the years that I've been following revisionism, it's always been about these forensics and demographics, and there seems to be nobody who is looking into the idea of this as a psychological warfare, that the idea of this extermination program was planted in the media before the war was over by groups like... Hillel Kook and the Bergson boys. It was a Irgun cell working out of Washington, D.C. with American gangsters and movie makers.
World Jewish Congress, and
the U.S. Congress, yeah. I mean, these
World Jewish Congress.
Well, yeah, World Jewish Congress, right. Okay. There's the World Jewish Congress and the B'nai B'rith and the War Refugee Board and a number of other... organizations, you know, that were sort of in on this thing. But there was also, since you've already discovered that Spielberg has been kind of dissembling somewhat. I mean, he's a filmmaker. He's left things out and he's allowed people to lie on film. There were also Hollywood movie makers that were with the field photography OSS units that are just as guilty of, you know, editing errors and they're not even errors of putting together a film as evidence for Nuremberg that claimed that these were gas chambers and that they have pictures of guys turning wheels and there's water pipes and stuff and we're all being led to believe that this is a system whereby this gas comes out of a shower head, which is preposterous,
exactly.
And they left it at that. So,
that was the original story that the gas came out of the shower heads through this elaborate Nazi engineered system. But of course, we found out that That's not possible. They didn't have any such equipment. And so now they claim that they just dropped the cyanide through holes in the roof, which is absurd, because just right across, even in Auschwitz, they had the equipment that's necessary to actually disperse and heat this Zyklon B that they didn't use in these alleged homicidal gas chambers.
Did you know that film footage was entered as evidence in a court of law for the first time in the history of jurisprudence at Nuremberg?
You know, I vaguely heard that, but wow, that's a huge point to bring to people, especially because of the involvement of film directors such as Billy Wilder and Alfred Hitchcock that were involved in actually filming these a lot of these projects at the camps.
George Stevens was at Dachau, and I think he was probably somehow involved in retrofitting that shower room there to make it look like a gas chamber. It's a movie set is what it is, and they shot newsreels, you know, and they would send these newsreels back. American audiences would see them. David Irving unearthed some information about one of these directors that was shooting concentration camp scenes in upstate New York. They had actors.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Dachau, what you bring up about the Dachau gas chamber, this is the most, you know, and I sort of regret not including this in the video, but I sort of ran out of time and just wanted to release somewhat of my new findings to people. But, yeah, the gas chamber at Dachau is such an obvious thing to bring to people. I only touch upon it in about 2 seconds in the video, real quick at the beginning, but, you know, as Charles says, there was a sign at this obviously crudely made post-war modified room that says gas chamber disguised as a shower room, never used as a gas chamber. Well,
yeah,
I
saw that sign. It's been removed. It was in 5 languages. It sat right in the middle of the room.
They keep changing the signs in these
places. Well, now it's gone.
Well, it's good to see you take pictures of them. So you have the picture and the date when this one was there, and then later they have something else.
But the idea is that somebody should actually, maybe a revisionist that's got some extra time or, you know, could look into the Hollywood angle, because here's Steven Spielberg. He's continuing to mythologize using film. And what they did was they helped create this myth right at the end of the war, as they were liberating the German camps. When they never got into the Auschwitz, because that was liberated by the Russians, but the Russians had filmmakers too that were concocting this legend.
Charlie, you know, I think you bring up psychological warfare, and you know, that's not all that different from political warfare, because it's used as, you know, for political reasons.
Right.
And so I'm interested now very much in anything that's along the lines of political warfare, because as I was talking to Eric earlier, you know, it all comes down to politics. The whole thing is being upheld for political reasons.
Right.
And so that's why when you bring out the truth, when you talk about truth telling and, well, why don't people, you know, pay attention to this? These things are crazy. They don't make sense. Well, it's like... It doesn't matter how much truth you bring out. They're not going to recognize.
Apparently, it doesn't matter at all.
No.
I mean, we were going at it the wrong way. We thought that everybody would wake up as soon as they were exposed to the truth, but nobody really cares, apparently. It's all about this, as you say, political warfare and psychology, working on their minds in a different way.
There's something I'd like to read for you. I don't know if Charles is talking about is that, you know, all right, so Charles is talking about that after the liberation of the camps, the Allies manufactured these phony gas chambers, such as the one at Dachau and the one shown to tourists at Auschwitz. So this is something I'd like to read to you about soap from human bodies. This is from a newspaper. It says Calgary Miner, Washington. It says soap from human bodies, another Nazi horror. London, December 4th. a concentration camp in which the Germans are said to have made soap from human bodies and purses and ersatz leather goods from human skin is described by an American officer, Lieutenant Colonel Edward York of San Antonio, states the Associated Press correspondent in Warsaw. Lieutenant Colonel York said he visited the human grist mill in the heart of Gdansk, where, in a group of buildings behind 5-foot walls, there were long aluminum vats which were under steam pressure and held 400 gallons of liquid. Alongside each, there were recipes on the wall describing how long parts of the human flesh were to be cooked and how to extract the fats for soap making. Some of the vats contained torsos, legs, and arms. So Polish investigators have ascertained that the scheme for making soap and other products was conceived by two German doctors. So it seems as if after the war, they actually made these little Hollywood sets, just like Charles said, to tour these journalists through. It's psychological warfare. They made a soap factory.
Eric, he probably wasn't even a journalist. He was a psychological warfare soldier who was masquerading as a journalist and planting stories. I mean, they were concocting these stories in offices. It was going on in London at the political warfare executive inside the MI5. Sir Bruce Lockhart was running a team that included, listen to this, C.D. Jackson, who was Eisenhower's intelligence advisor and buddy, and also William S. Paley, that was running CBS after the war, Bill Paley.
Yeah, I mean, in my last movie, I show the names of these people involved in the psychological warfare unit. Almost all of them are Jewish. And these are the people that put the shrunken human heads at Buchenwald, the lampshades, etc. And we have a duty as Americans to take this horrific libel mistake that our government did and reverse it. Sorry.
Yeah, I think we do. And if we could, there's some, these guys, these filmmakers, you know, and the OSS, those field photography teams, those professionals that were sent over there from Hollywood.
Yeah.
They must have gone to their graves knowing what they'd done. That just blows my mind that they had this secret that they kept, you know, because they were promoting the idea of these gas chambers and they never found any.
Yeah. Would you think if this was all done for, you know, before the end of the war, supposedly they're in war, so they had to, you know, they always do all this stuff, create all this atrocity stuff. And then afterwards, you know, they kind of let it. Well, supposedly afterwards, the countries become friendly again, and then that all dies out or they admit it or something. But this time it's different. And you think it's because... what was I going to ask? Why is it different?
I think the Russians have a stake in keeping the records to themselves. I think that they don't want to release them because I think they've been asked and they said no to some of the records that they made off with.
I just came up with my own answer. It's not just the Russians though. None of them want to let up on this. None of the allied countries. And so it seems they're in a new kind of thing where they're going to use it forever. You know, they're not going to become friendly again. It's not going to become nations working together again. It's already not. You know, it's going to be, it's a globalized thing.
Carolyn, listen, why haven't the Muslim countries contributed any revisionist information to this search for the truth?
We don't even need
money
that information.
In the Middle East
I don't know, but I don't really care if they are or not.
We don't need their information. We could use a little bit of financing.
That's what I was thinking. We could use some financing.
Oh yeah. All right. Get some of those rich sheiks.
Yeah, those oil sheiks. These people that are supposed to be anti-Zionists. I don't know why they don't pony up with some of those oil, you know, petrodollars.
Some of those people are not what they say they are. You know, a lot of people aren't what they say they are. I mean, I don't know where you go to find truth.
Yeah. But, anyway, it just seems odd that after all these years that somebody hasn't, from the Islamic camp, hasn't stepped forward with the contribution to the cause.
Some people should be going after big money folks. They should be. And I can't imagine that there wouldn't be some that would be agreeable.
I would think if they could be approached.
Yeah, you have to have someone who can approach them. I'm not that person.
I don't know. But I mean, anyway,
I wanted to say, too, that the Frankfurt Schoolers were at Nuremberg, that Herbert Marcuse was tasked to help organize the trial, and that I think that guy's name was Naumann, the guy that wrote Behemoth, which was the text that everybody was using to try to understand National Socialism. He was from the Frankfurt School. He was a Marxist. These Marxists were heavily recruited for intelligence operations, and especially the denazification program in Germany after the war.
That's right. Then
there's these Ritchie boys. Nobody's looked into this thing. 10,000 German speaking, fresh off the boat Jewish interrogators, clerks, disinformation agents, and that kind of thing.
Charles, you should write a script and send it to Eric. I mean, you know, don't just keep saying somebody should look into this. You're the one that knows all about it.
I just don't hear it being discussed. These are areas of investigation that, to me, have been overlooked.
No, you bring up a real good point, because revisionism has been pretty much from the beginning about the forensics and demographics and so on, but mainly the forensics. And that was there under that illusion that we were talking about, that when people get the truth, they will respond to it. But it hasn't turned out that way.
No, it hasn't. We haven't been making much headway.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that's true. I think even since the release of my last movie, I've seen an explosion of revisionist sympathetic sites on the internet. I think the problem in the past was, I think, that we didn't make videos, etc. Who wants to really read a 1,600-page Scott dissertation? And another thing is that when you see what some of these Jews say written down, it sort of seems somewhat believable. But when you see the actual video of them, it's absurd, because we've all seen liars, and we can see their body language. They're lying, and it's absurd.
Yeah, you're right. And I think it was the Nierbud that came up with the idea that the revisionism would be turning away from text and going into these shorter videos and production numbers, you know, productions.
Yeah, he's awesome. Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he was right on the cusp of this change in the media, and he understood what it's going to take. And I think you're absolutely right that our attention span for all of this heavy research and footnoted documentation is going just as fast as everybody else is, because of my computer. You know, I can't bring myself to read as much as I used to. So I think.
We could actually create. I mean, it's comedic in some way. If you see a Michael Moore documentary, he's very effective because he uses a lot of comedy in his documentaries. Of course, he also approaches it from he mentions a lot of the serious aspects of it. But a lot of these most very effective documentaries and most popular ones, they use a lot of comedy. But really, we've only just begun doing that. Mostly we've been limited because of our budgets, etc. But that's something we should be working on for sure. And me personally, comedy is one of the reasons I eventually totally decided that I am an atheist. George Carlin, you know, he just cut through all the lies, and something like that is probably necessary to really wake people up.
Yeah. Well, but not everybody's an atheist, Eric, so I wouldn't push that overly much mixed in with the revisionism, but of course that's just my opinion. but I think the comedy, you know, these people when you just photograph them and when you, I mean, when you have them on tape and so on, they're all hilariously funny, but it's also so serious, you know, so you have, and that's really makes it even more interesting because, you can't help but see the humor in it, but at the same time, the terrible, serious consequences that have come.
Imagine if we actually had somewhat of a budget, we could do reenactments of Irene sifting through, you know, diamonds with some chocolate, substituting for what she said she
sifted through. I wouldn't actually go for that.
There are ways we can actually have somewhat of a humorous approach.
Well, then it would get really down in the gutter. I don't know. I don't think I'd go for that. I think that these people make themselves is...
There was a movie called Seven Beauties that had a scene with one of those Italian matinee idols diving into a concentration camp latrine.
Oh, that's also on Schindler's List. It's there's a scatological fascination with this.
A movie showing I think that would be good. A film that showed all the scatological tendencies of these Jews. Yeah.
I think I approached that in the last Days of the Big Lie. I showed how Spielberg also did the latrine scene with the little boy in Schindler's List and the children.
But I mean, a film that was all that. What if you did all of it?
you don't want to see the chocolate, but you want to see an entire film of
No, I don't want to see a whole film.
Logical.
I don't want to see an actress.
Yeah, I don't either.
We don't have to stoop so low. I think that we need to do this. I think we have to capture the imaginations of these young hipster types that are, you know, coming into their adulthood now, and we can do it with media rather than literature.
Yeah, as long as you can keep the media going. You know, I don't want to bring in a negative note here, but you know, some people are thinking that they're going to take the internet away. And, you know, if you start making headway in something like this in any way, that's when they take away your ability to do it. So keep that in mind. You know, we could make all kinds of plans, but then they'll just pull the plug.
They're already starting to pull the plug a little bit, I think. And they've probably have legislation in place to pull more of the plug. I mean, it's just waiting in the wings.
Well, let's not
pulling the plug. They're just watching everything you do to make sure you don't do anything approaching anything illegal.
Mostly don't want is success. I mean, the people way at the top. If you start being successful, say like Golden Dawn was, that's when they do something. Oh, here's the 60 seconds. I was trying to say a little bit earlier that Eric, you're the star of this show, so let's let you have the last minute here.
Well, thanks for Garmar and Charles to call in, but I'd like everyone to check out my new documentary. It's at gaschamberhoax.com. Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm glad you've been on. And, you know, with Garmar and Charles calling in, it's just a natural, I thought, you know, I probably should set up some roundtable programs on this Saturday afternoon program and get a group of revisionists a few different times.
Yeah. We have to hide our views in public, so when we actually meet in discussion like this, we just want to talk it a mile a minute. But you should.
Yeah, I'll put my attention on that. So Charles, thank you so much for
welcome.
Don't hang up until after the music gets started or we won't hear it. So I think, somebody already did, so we're not hearing it. No, here we hear it. Okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, the show is over. Have a nice weekend.
Okay.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.